and welcome back to Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How about you?
Not too bad.
All right.
Not too bad.
Good to hear. And we are talking some basketball history, as we like to do, telling a few stories about basketball history, perhaps. Now that we're at the Step Back, enjoying life there, hopefully everyone's getting into what we're doing. We are going to talk about teams that blew a 3-1 lead. It isn't just the Warriors. Other teams have done it in the past.
Wait, what happened? Wait, hold on. What happened?
I believe that the Warriors may have blown a 3-1 lead in the finals.
Really? See, I don't watch modern basketball. I'm so, you know, strapped into the NBA history that I have no idea what's going on in modern basketball. So I did not know that. I'll have to go on the internet and see if anybody has spoken about that or if it's been a topic that has been discussed. I'll do that after the show. Yeah, but, you know, you did a very good job researching all this, but I had no idea of that. So thank you for enlightening me there. So
your knowledge of basketball only extends to the previous season.
Exactly. Yeah. What I do is I watch League Pass, but I watch like the games from last year or whatever. Yeah. So like I'm just now getting through and the Warriors are doing great. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on with you guys, but they just won an NBA championship in my world.
And
the Houston Rockets, we'll talk about them. They're flying high too. You know, it's not all the way there, but they won a 7-game series. You know, things are looking up for the Rockets. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in my league. So I don't know about what's going on with you guys, but mine's doing pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. So, I won't let you know because I don't want to spoil things for you, Rich. So
yeah, please don't. No spoiler alerts.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. All right. Well, we'll dive into the past. We'll go into safe territory where we're not going to ruin anybody's day. And, we'll let the future decide itself. So,
okay, good.
So we begin with the very first time that a team blew a 3-1 lead in an NBA series. It actually took 21 seasons and 48 best of 7 playoff series before an NBA team lost a playoff series after taking a 3-1 lead. It was the 1968 Eastern Division Finals, the Celtics beating the 76ers. And we've talked about this game in our WrestleMania series, which you can go back to and listen to if you want to. We've discussed it a few times in our episodes discussing Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain. So you'll pick any of those and you'll find it for sure. And you find some other good stuff too. This is, of course, happening at a terrible time in American history where Martin Luther King was assassinated just a day before Game 1 on April 4th, 1968. There were a lot of anxious feelings about playing the game on both sides. There were calls to cancel the series. They ended up playing Game 1 on the day it was scheduled and then delaying for a few days for the memorials and all that sort of thing. So, at this point, the Celtics had lost to the 76ers for the previous season. It was the first time they'd lost after 8 straight championships, 54-28. Their key players were Bill Russell, John Havlicek, Bailey Howell, and Sam Jones. And in the second year under a player coach, Bill Russell. This is definitely, a chance for Russell to, get back at Chamberlain after the loss before to kind of prove his credentials as coach, because it was his first year as coach where the Celtics had finally lost the championship. Meanwhile, the 76ers, Wilt Chamberlain, Hal Greer, Billy Cunningham, and Chet Walker just have incredible talent, down from 68 wins to 62, but still lead the league in SRS and incredible coach in Alex Hannum.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about the Celtics, and we talked about this during our WrestleMania series as well, is that you're going into the second year of player coach Bill Russell. You know, obviously that first year, as you mentioned, he loses, in the NBA Finals, which is the thing, in Boston, that's probably like not a, don't do that because we don't do that. We don't lose. So to have it come here where he's in another situation where his back's against the wall and he might lose here, like, we don't know exactly what was going to happen. We don't know if they were going to fire or whatever, but it could have really been a big deal if in another season of Bill Russell under control of the Celtics, they lose to the 76ers. In a big time game or whatever, that could, I don't know if that would change the trajectory all that much of Bill Russell player coach or what would have happened, but you have to imagine 2 years of not winning a title after what they had just went through would not go over all that well in Boston.
Not at all. And he definitely heard it, during that offseason and felt like people definitely did not appreciate the fact that they had won 8 in a row and maybe, just give him a little bit of break on the one that they lost. It's really interesting to hear. I guess when there's just that expectation, you lose your common sense. I don't know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's not like fans to be irrational, of course.
No. And luckily they've outgrown that, basketball fans in general.
Oh, just, yeah.
You know, are much more calm about things these days. Sure. So that's good.
Yeah, calm and rational. We like that. So
we let things play out a little. We don't react instantly. No. It's not like we have tools to react to. No, we wait it out. We see how it goes a few, you know, and then we go back and we look and we kind of analyze from that at standpoint. Yeah. It's not instant reactions these days in 2016. No, you let it play out.
Which is good. We write long letters and then we wait to send them until we feel comfortable with what we've said.
Exactly. Yeah. I do bottle messages. I only do messages in the bottle, nice. Which unfortunately, in Illinois is a little tough. I mean, we have Lake Michigan, but it just kind of floats there. And then I have to go pretty far to get to the Mississippi River, and that just doesn't really go where I want either. You know, yeah, like whoever, who I don't even know who gets these things, but that's all right.
That's all right. So Celtics won game one in Philly. The Sixers won the next three. And there were two games in Philly left to play. This was all without Billy Cunningham, who was injured in the previous series. However, things helped turn around. Sam Jones had a 37-point game five. In game six, despite 40 points from Hal Greer, they sent the game back to Philly for game seven. And the Celtics won it in by only 4 points, where they'd go on to beat the Lakers in the finals. Not a surprise they would beat the Lakers. yeah. Wilt shot 20-48 from the free throw line from games 5 to 7. And they lost those games by a combined 30 points. So that was 28 points that they left on the table during that time. Yeah. Not quite fair to expect him to make all those free throws, but it would have been nice. You know, 75%, something like that. Even 60% would have been okay. And Russell really clamped down on Chamberlain in the second half of Game 7. He only had 2 shot attempts, and it was very close down the line. Russell managed to get a free throw, blocked a shot by Chet Walker, and then rebound a miss of Hal Greer, and then passed it to Sam Jones, who was able to clinch it with a basket. So, and then Russell, after beating the Lakers in the finals, he was named a Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, kind of a peak achievement of his career, kind of showing like, okay, he wasn't quite done yet. And they would then win the finals again in 1969, in Russell's final season, giving him 11 championships in 13 years. Whereas the 76ers, Wilt Chamberlain demanded a trade to the ended up going to the Lakers, but they still managed a strong season. They had Jack Ramsey as their coach, who had been their GM, and unfortunately, though, they lost the in the Eastern Division semis to, again, Boston. So pesky Boston, always beating Philly during those
damn
times.
Celtics, yeah, man. They just beat the Lakers, beat Philadelphia. They should have, the Lakers and the Sixers should have just come together for like 1 year and be like, look, we're just going to combine teams just one time. Like, let's do this. Let's try to beat the Celtics.
There you go.
Even an offseason series of like, all right, they beat them every year. Like, we get really close every time. Let's just combine our powers and see what we can do. I've been interesting.
Yeah. There you go. So the next one, it happens a year later in the ABA. The only time in the ABA that a 3-1 lead was broken, it was the Indiana Pacers beating the Kentucky Colonels. They were fairly equal teams in terms of record, although the Pacers were much a stronger SRS team. The Pacers had Mel Daniels, Roger Brown, Freddie Lewis, and Bob Nadolicki. This is right at the beginning of their dynasty. Meanwhile, the Colonels have Louis Dampier and Daryl Carrier, who you wrote about quite a bit as being one of the really first great backcourt tandems to use the three-point line quite a bit. Of course, the ABA had the three-point line. The NBA did not have it during that time. So it was the second year in the ABA, so they were really able – or the third year, I believe. But so they were able to go to town, so to speak.
Yeah, Dampier with 552 three-point attempts and Carrier with 330. And to their credit, they shot 36.1% for Dampier and then 37.9% for Carrier, which are really great numbers in those times, especially for that high of a volume, which, you know, now that's kind of commonplace. You know, 500 three-point attempts is nothing in today's game. But if you look at, you know, the other teams, I mean, that's more than in total teams did in the league. Is, you know, Dampier alone, you know, lapped numerous teams in the ABA. So it was certainly just an absolute, you know, out of nowhere thing. And they were one of the first teams to really embrace it and use it successfully as well.
The Pacers actually lost the final game of the regular season in Kentucky, and then they lost their playoff opener to the Colonels 6 days later. And then they were able later to pull out a 121-115 victory, their first postseason win in franchise history, which featured a wild fight after Jim Caldwell gave a hard foul to Mel Daniels. The Pacers' backup center, George Peoples, attacked Caldwell, and Daniels got a big shot of his own, which was captured in a famous photograph in the following day's Indianapolis Star. And nobody was ejected from the game, and Daniels did not even get a technical foul. So eventually, after the 3-1 lead, the Pacers were able to pull it out with a Game 7 victory witnessed by a record crowd at the time in Indianapolis. In fact, the players received a 1-minute standing ovation at the start of the game, and Dampier, 26 points, Gene Moore, 22, and Goose Ligon had 20, where Ned Olicki had 32 points, Roger Brown had 29, and the Pacers were able to pull it out with a huge third quarter. And Slick Leonard was carried off the court by his players at the end. Pacers would end up in the ABA Finals, where they would lose, but the next season they would go back to the ABA Finals and beat the Los Angeles Stars in 6 games. Yep. Meanwhile, Kentucky would improve a little bit the next season, and then they would lose to the Indiana Pacers next year in the Eastern Division Finals. So after 21 seasons without them, we get 3 years in a row, albeit in two different leagues. 1970 Western Division Semifinals, Lakers over the Suns. The Lakers were 46-36. The Suns were 39-43. Lakers had Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, and Wilt Chamberlain. Of course, he had been injured for much of the regular season, only played 12 games there. Actually came back early for the playoffs, and quite courageously, honestly. The Suns had Paul Silas, Connie Hawkins, Dick Van Arsdale, and Gail Goodrich, a former Laker who would go back to the Lakers in just a couple of seasons, but had sort of emerged as a all-star caliber player while in Phoenix. Lakers won game one. The Suns then fairly easily took the next 3 games before the Lakers got it going in game 5. The Suns were 8th in SRS in a 14-team league, so that would have made it a pretty big upset. The Lakers were not a great regular season team that year, a lot of it because of Wilt's injury. Baylor was getting older, and West was almost always dealing with injuries. So like injuries playing a big part in their struggles and age, of course, as well. And the turning point, though, was, you know, Wilt really started to get it going late in the series.
Yeah, you know, they had a lot of trouble getting him into the flow of the offense. Obviously, he had been hurt all year, like you had said, and it was kind of hard to kind of get things going. But things just seemed to click in game 5. From that point on, the Lakers, you know, dominated the series. They won the final 3 games by a combined 63 points. Jerry West had 2 35-point games, and Wilt chipped in 30 of his own in games 5 and 7 to end all hopes of an upset for Phoenix. So, darn.
Yeah.
Almost there, Phoenix. Sorry.
Almost, yeah. Next year, the Lakers would win 48 games, despite Elgin Baylor only playing 2 games that season. They beat the Bulls in the opening round, but they lost to the Bucks and Kareem in the Western Conference Finals. I believe West was hurt in that Western Conference Finals as well. The following season, however, Baylor would retire. They'd win 33 games in a row and finish with 69 wins, setting a record for the time and then beating the Knicks for the NBA championship. Meanwhile, the Suns would be up 48 wins under new coach Cotton Fitzsimmons. However, they would miss the playoffs. Despite a 9-win improvement, wouldn't make the playoffs again until 76. Now, this was a weird time where, you know, they had just split from divisions into conferences. I think actually 71 would be the first year that happened. And they had weird rules for a while where the top 2 teams from each division made the playoffs. So you could have a much worse record and make the playoffs if you just happen to be in the right division. So they got rid of that after a few seasons and then made it more fair. There were still some, you know, odd ones here and there. And of course, conferences, there's you know, we see conference disparity prevents, you know, good teams from making the playoffs every once in a while, although it's usually not quite that, you know, that bad of a situation.
Yeah, this one, in this particular, the San Francisco Warriors, they were 41-41, but just so happened to be in the Pacific Division. So they made it in, was the Suns. They were 3rd in the Midwest Division because there was the Milwaukee Bucks and the Chicago Bulls ahead of them. So, yeah, the Suns win 48. And actually, that Midwest Division was stacked. I mean, you had the Bucks 66-16, the Bulls at 51-31, the Suns at 48-34, and then the Detroit Pistons were 4th in that division at 45-37, but they missed the playoffs despite the fact that they were, what, you know, 3 games worse than the number one team in the Pacific Division, the Los Angeles Lakers. So yeah, that was just the division's not quite being good. So I cannot even imagine the outrage today if that would have happened. And we still get it bad, like you said, but not nearly like this bad, where Detroit, you know, doesn't even sniff the playoffs and they're 4 games better than, you know, the Warriors. So
yeah, exactly. So so next we have the 79 Eastern Conference Finals. So things, it takes a while for the next 3-1 lead. The end of the decade, the Washington Bullets going over the San Antonio Spurs. The Bullets were the defending NBA champions, 54-win team with a strong SRS, 4.75, although the Spurs actually was fairly close, 4.97, which led the league that year. Elvin Hayes, Bob Dandridge, Wes Unseld also there. He's 32, starting to show his age. Hayes is a little bit as well. Meanwhile, the Spurs have George Gervin and Larry Keenan. And they have George Karl on their team, one of the a future coach, George Karl, of course. And yes, the Spurs were in the Eastern Conference for that time, just for I believe 3 seasons after the merger, they would be in the Eastern Conference, and eventually things would align in 81. And George Gervin played really well during this series. He scored 34 points in game one, 42 in game four. But the Bullets were able to turn it around in games five and six.
You know, effective work from Elvin Hayes. He had 24 points in game five to really help the Bullets, 25 points in game six as well. So he was a big part of it. And the Spurs actually, you know, in the game seven, which there is a YouTube video, I believe, that has almost the entire game seven, if you are interested in checking it out. They led for most of the second half of game seven until there was a furious Washington rally late in the fourth that led the Bullets to the 1979 NBA Finals, of course, defeating the Spurs. But it was not without controversy, because after the game, Doug Moe, the San Antonio Spurs head coach, had some pointed comments about the officiating late in the game. We'll get his quote here in a little bit, but in the final 3 minutes and 39 seconds, nine fouls were called with seven against the Spurs. So seven of those nine were called against the Spurs. Washington went 11 for 15 from the foul line in the final quarter, while the Spurs only made 3 of 4. So Doug Moe after the game said the refs stole it. John Vanek and Paul Malik wouldn't make a call for us at the end. It was a great refereed game, and then they just stole it at the end. It makes you wonder if it was on purpose. They should be set before the firing squad. I don't know if you could say that anymore, Doug. I feel like that would not go over well.
That would not go over well.
Washington stole their way into the NBA Finals. Vanek just takes over and puts it into you. Who knows if it's personal? So Doug Moe not happy. So he wants them to be shot via firing squad, the referees. But definitely a lot of frustration in there, and it's still a point of contention for some Spurs fans, is that was kind of stolen from them, and that they would have beat the Bullets had not for, you know, the referees kind of not refereeing well or whatever it may be. But people still kind of look at that as a big moment. So I don't know. I wasn't there in the moment, so I can't say. But it does. That discrepancy is pretty bad, but just on its face, it's hard to really, you know, discrepancies can come from a lot of different ways. And, you know, the Bullets, of course, were a team that were pretty good at drawing fouls as well. So
yeah, and they had a lot of inside scoring where the Spurs were more perimeter-oriented team. So
exactly.
I don't know if Gervin was particularly strong at drawing fouls. I know, you know, he was obviously more of a jump shooter, but he may have had that skill as well. But either way, yes. Interesting. Certainly pointed comments from old Doug.
The never opinionated Doug Moe. Right. Doug Moe usually quiet and keeps to himself. So that was good that he let himself out for a moment.
So the teams, they kept pretty much things together, but neither team did particularly well the next season. The Bullets fell quite a bit, winning only 39 games, losing in the first round of the Eastern Conference playoffs. Injuries were a combination there. We actually have a show upcoming looking at the late 70s Bullets, which I think will had great guests, and we'll have some interesting insight into the end of that team. And then the Spurs won 41 games, but Doug Moe was let go in the season's final stretch, and they lost in the first round to the Rockets, who were also in the East. And that was the final year those two teams were in the Eastern Conference before Dallas would come into the league the next season, and that would be a realignment, which would basically put teams that, you know, in the conferences as we pretty much know them today. Obviously, the teams have been added since then, but you know, the 23 teams at the time were pretty much in the conferences as we know them today.
Yeah. Exactly.
So next is the 1981 Eastern Conference Finals, the Celtics beating the 76ers. And both teams had identical 62 wins, and were both very strong SRS teams. The Celtics 6.05 And the 76ers, 7.76, which very nice. You know, 76, 76ers, you know.
It's like they tried. Yeah. They tried. They're like, what's our SRS?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure Dr. J was very concerned about, you know, winning by the exact right margin in the, you know, exactly, in the tough road games to be able to.
And telling other other parts of the league, too, to like to stay stable. We're good. You know, don't everyone keep their margins exactly the same. We got to get this. The stat that has not been created yet in about, you know, 20 years maybe will be created. Yeah. Please, let's all hold off and let's try to do it. But thank you. I'm glad he did do that.
Yeah, I'm sure they talked to John Vanek and Paul Millak and, you know, got them to, you know, exactly get the point differential, you know, at the right spot. So anyway, the Celtics had Larry Bird, of course, led the team in scoring and rebounding. Robert Parrish, who had, this was his first year on the team, had been traded from Golden State along with rookie Kevin McHale. Cedric Maxwell and Tiny Archibald also on the team. Meanwhile, the Sixers have Bobby Jones, Daryl Dawkins, and Maurice Cheeks, and a lot of great players that they would have. I think Andrew Tony was a rookie during this time as well. Mm-hmm. And so what happened, Rich?
Yeah, so the Celtics weathered, you know, a 3-1 deficit from the 76ers to eventually eliminate them. Larry Bird, who was looking for revenge after the Sixers had beaten the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals the year before, he exploded for 32 points in Game 5 and chipped in 25 and 23 in Game 6 and 7. The final kind of stretch, Bobby Jones chased down a defensive rebound 80 feet from the basket and smartly called a timeout with just a second left in the series to give the 76ers one final chance. So they have one final chance to, you know, finally be able to kind of, you know, not lose the Celtics, get this one, you know, get another victory, get another huge win against the Celtics. It did not work, though. After leading for most of the last three games, including double-digit advantage each time, they lost each and every time, and yet the Celtics, they still, or the Sixers, rather, they had one final chance to reverse all that late-game negative momentum, all the stuff that had happened, to finally kind of, you know, let this, you know, not worry about the Celtics anymore. With the ball advanced to half court, Cunningham drew up a play, that was Coach Billy Cunningham drew up a play for an alley-oop lob for Julius Erving, which makes sense. You got one, you know, you got a second left and you got Julius Erving on your team. Not a bad play. But Bird's leaping, hands extended defense forced Jones to throw a difficult 50-foot pass way too high. Erving was open briefly, but the pass sailed off the top of the middle of the backboard, too high for even the doctor to soar and reach. And it took a weird bounce to the Boston bench, and a bunch of fans ran onto the court, and that was it for the 76ers. So not a bad play, you know, it seems like a good idea, but just didn't quite work. As far as the turning point of the series or what really kind of shifted it all, it's hard to say. There wasn't really one point. I mean, five of the seven games were decided by one score, including two that came down to a single point. The others, only game two, an 18-point Celtics win, was a true blowout. So it was as close of a, you know, dropping it through an advantage as any, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't necessarily that, you know, the Sixers had it in hand and completely blew it. It was a back and forth series the entire time. It just so happened that the Celtics were just better on this particular time. So not really a huge turning point, just kind of a well-played series, and one that a lot of people still regard as one of the better seven game series of all time, just because it was always close and it was always a back and forth affair.
Yeah. And two great teams, of course, you know,
and yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Close yeah, teams. You know. Yeah. So really, you know, really, amazing series as well, and next year things would be another great competitive series where the Sixers would get a 3-1 lead and almost lose it, but managed to win it in Game 7. The Celtics won 63 games that year and lost to the Sixers, who won 58 games that year in the Eastern Conference Finals. And the Sixers would make the finals, but then lose in 6 to the Lakers. And then that would prompt them to make the trade that would bring in Moses Malone and the Fofofo 83 season that's famous in 76ers history.
Absolutely.
And then 1995, the Western Conference semifinals, the Houston Rockets beat the Phoenix Suns. It was the first time since 68 that a lower seeded team came back from a 3-1 deficit to win the series. Phoenix completely blitzed the Rockets in games 1 and 2. Houston did come back with a pretty big win in game 3, and then Phoenix won a narrow 4-point win in game 4. Looked like, of course, they're doing pretty well. The Rockets, 47-35 that year, only a 2.32 SRS. We had a whole show on the 95 Rockets. Not just the Rockets, but looking back at 1995, and a lot of it was on the Rockets with Adi Joseph of the Sporting News, which is everyone should check out if you haven't. And the talked a lot about that team. Hakeem Olajuwon, of course, Clyde Rexer, who came over in a midseason trade, Sam Cassell, Robert Horry, Kenny Smith, Vernon Maxwell, and then the Suns, 59-23 that year, 3.85 SRS. Charles Barkley is still there, leads the team in scoring and rebounding. Dan Majerle, Kevin Johnson, Danny Manning had been added as well from Atlanta. And so the Rockets were 6th seed this year, and this is famously they managed to, I think every team they beat in every round had 59 or more wins during that time. So just completely, beat teams.
Yeah, it's a hellacious run.
Yeah. crazy. So, and then in a lot of it, of course, was Hakeem Olajuwon.
Yeah, so Hakeem, he averaged 30 points per game for the final three games of the series, including a 30-point, 10-assist, 8-rebound, 5-block performance in Game 6. And we talked a lot about that game in that podcast that we mentioned before. Charles Barkley and Kevin Johnson were just as brilliant, especially in Game 7, where Barkley had 23 rebounds and Kevin Johnson had 46 points. But in the end, it was Mario Elie who sealed the deal for Houston, a famous shot from Mario Elie. You know, they got all these stars and all these great players, and it's Mario Elie that really does the thing. Here's a report from the LA Times with Scott Howard Cooper that wrote this. The Rockets facing elimination for the 5th time this postseason and the 8th in the last two turned not to Hakeem Olajuwon or Clyde Drexler for the life preserver, but Mario Elie. He responded by swishing a baseline three-pointer with 7.1 seconds left that broke a 110-110 tie and propelled them to a 115-114 victory over the Phoenix Suns in Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals. Everyone counted us out. Phoenix was going to beat us in 6, as Mario Elie talking as well. Utah was going to beat us in 4, but both of those teams, they're going to be watching us. So that was Mario Elie, very happy. And he, of course, did the kiss, the famous kiss after he made the shot. But just an incredible run for this Houston Rockets team, who just at no point in any part of the season looked like they were going to win the NBA championship until they actually, won the NBA. It's just a crazy year. One of the craziest years, I'd say, almost of any NBA champion in history.
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that run is pretty much unparalleled for just the tough sledding they had. And even though they'd won the championship the year before, so they clearly had that ability to do so, but they had, changed the team over quite a bit and had a lot to prove and were able to make an amazing thing. I think the Celtics in 68, coming back from, or excuse me, the Celtics in 69, that last run that they made, I think is one that's, pretty comparable, but there aren't many that come close to that. So the Rockets the next season won 48 games, looked like they were, still going pretty strong, but they were swept by the Supersonics in the Western Conference semifinals, and they would acquire Charles Barkley from the Suns, who that year only won 41 games and lost in the first round in 4 games to the Spurs, 3-1. So big changes for them after that season.
Yeah, it would never quite be the same for either franchise until they kind of, yeah. It took almost a decade for both franchises kind of get a little bit back, on footing. Obviously, yeah. Nash coming to the Suns really kind of got them back. And the Rockets, of course, Yao Ming and Trace McGrady in that little era kind of got them going.
Yeah, the Suns had some okay late 90s teams, but
the Jason Kidd years, but until they acquired Stephon Marbury, then that didn't go well. Yeah. It did not, but that's okay. Hey.
So, 1997 Eastern Conference semifinals, the Heat beat the Knicks, and this one was Eastern Conference basketball from the late 90s through the early 2000s. Generally not the prettiest to watch, and the pace rating was 87.6, and the teams managed to only score more than 100 points just once between the two. So, not so great.
No, and what's weird is these teams have some pretty good players on both sides, like dynamic scorers as well. The Miami Heat, they were a 61-21 this year with a 5.56 SRS. Their key players are Tim Hardaway, who led the team in scoring and assists, Alonzo Mourning, Jamal Mashburn. The big storyline, though, here was the coach of Miami was, of course, Pat Riley. This was his second year in Miami after 4 years in New York. Famously, in 1995, Riley resigned from the Knicks via fax to become the head coach and the team president of the Miami Heat. The move caused a lot of controversy as the Heat were accused by the Knicks of tampering or pursuing Riley while he still had a year remaining on his contract. The matter was settled after the Heat sent their 1996 first-round pick, which the Knicks would use to draft Walter McCartney, and $1 million cash to the Knicks on September 1st, 1995. And then, of course, so it would really add that extra little bits of the rivalry too. And these teams just generally hated each other as well. The New York Knicks, they were 57-25 this year with a 3.31 SRS. Their key players were Patrick Ewing, who led the team in both points and rebounds, Allen Houston, John Starks, Larry Johnson, and Charles Oakley. The big turning point of this entire series, I mean, this is a clear line of when this series completely changed around, was Game 5. It was P.J. Brown and Charlie Ward. They got in a fight. It saw P.J. Brown basically flip or body slam Charlie Ward into the crowd, which was just a hellacious, you know, body slam as well. And so it caused a big melee. A bunch of people left the bench. A bunch of things happened. And essentially what happened is there were suspensions to Patrick Ewing, Larry Johnson, Allen Houston, and John Starks, which, by the way, were four of the Knicks' top six players in win shares. So it completely changed the series from there. The Knicks, who had cruised to a 3-1 lead in the series, had to play games 6 and 7 shorthanded due to the NBA staggering the suspension. So they didn't do all the suspensions all at once. They staggered them, which probably hurt them even more than if they had just done it all at once. So, and the result was the first trip to the conference finals for the Miami Heat. Patrick Ewing, not so happy about this. This is from a New York Times piece as well. He says, in a way, I feel like I was robbed, but that's life. I believed in my teammates. I thought we had a great team. The chemistry was great. Everything was great. We played extremely well, but it just didn't happen. I still don't think I did anything to be suspended for, but that's just the way the NBA is.
Indeed. Yeah. So, I don't know if it really would have made, I mean, they definitely could have won the series and they were primed to win this series. I don't know in the scheme of things, if they were going to be winning, you know, beating the Bulls that year, probably not, but, it is interesting. Was that the rule that ended up, you know, where players couldn't leave the bench? Any bench would lead to a suspension. Any leaving the
yes.
bench, I believe that's what when that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That is the one. Yeah. We'll talk about it here in a little bit because it does affect another team that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Not a team that lost a series, but a team that would in the next year after losing a series, you know, have some issues as well. But we'll get to that right here in a second.
So the next year would win 55 games and would lose in the Eastern Conference first round in 5 games to the Knicks, who won 43 games that year, so quite a decent upset there. And then fell to Indiana in 5 games in the second round. So,
and that's the famous, I believe that is the series with the Van Gundy holding onto the leg and all that sort of stuff. That series was
That's right.
That was even uglier, that one, yeah. I think, because that was just the one where every game was just a fight between those two teams, and it was just like the basketball was awful, and it was just fighting all the time. It was just a mess, but yeah, there you go. So.
There you go, yeah. Well, that's when basketball, that's when these guys were tough, you know? Right, you know, tough, play yeah. defense.
Those games are awful. Go watch a highlight.
Yeah.
Those games suck.
I'm not quite as anti those games as you are, but yeah, it's definitely not, it definitely bogs down into some very unpleasing basketball. It's something.
It's just Pat Riley. What are you doing, Pat?
Yeah,
come on.
You know, I guess it worked in a sense, but at the time. But yeah, I'm glad we pay. I'm glad there's more pace now. You know, I wouldn't mind a little more variety sometimes now. But I do like.
Yeah, it'd be fun for like one or two teams to like run this style and just try to like absolutely grind you down to a halt. Like the Grizzlies kind of do it, but not
as much anymore.
Extent, so.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Well, see, I'm a year behind. So
that's right. Yes.
So how did it go? Wait, what?
Never mind.
Is Zach Randolph still good or what?
So next we have the 2003 Eastern Conference first round, the Pistons over the Magic. Oh, this is an interesting one.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite series of all time because I'm a unabashed Tracy McGrady hater. So this was especially in this this time I was. Very much a Tracy McGrady here because I like Dirk and my friends all like Tracy McGrady and I had to be like, no, you know, and you had to draw a line in the sand because we were like
you have
14. So it couldn't be one. It couldn't be both. You couldn't like Tracy McGrady and Dirk. It was like you either won one of them is good and the other is awful. So I chose Dirk as good and Tracy McGrady was awful. So
I think you are the only person who's ever had to pick between Dirk and Tracy McGrady, but you know, like Tracy McGrady, Vince Carter. Yeah. Like, okay.
No,
yeah,
well, Tracy no, cause I was a Vince guy too. So I think that played a little bit into it too, cause I was a Vince guy as well. So it was kind of a, you did have to choose that, but I remember a distinct argument being Dirk versus Tracy McGrady. I do not know why, but there you go.
That was right before my super NBA fandom. So I do not remember that, but all right, I'll take your word for it, Rich.
I don't think anybody else did this. I think it was only me and my like group of friends.
Right,
so I just think this was like a national thing of like, who would you choose Tracy McGrady or this tall German guy?
All right. Well, if anybody else ever had that fight, you can let us know on
yes,
on Twitter or Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So Yeah, so this was the first time the first round was a best of seven format. They changed the rule that year. And in fact, if the Magic had gotten a 3-1 lead, the series would have been over because that would have that, of course, it would have been a 5-game series. And the Pistons were the number one seed. The Magic were the 8 seed. So that, of course, would have been, you know, that would have made history. Only the second time that would have, or I guess the third time that would have happened in the first round. So that would have been big. However, under the new rules, the Pistons had a chance to come back. The Pistons were right on the edge of, you know, getting their really great teams. They had Rip Hamilton, Chauncey Billups, Ben Wallace. Deshaun Prince was coming off the bench. I think he was a rookie that year. So he was new. They also had Clifford Robinson, Corus Williamson. In addition, they would make the big trade next year for Rasheed Wallace that would change their fortunes and let them to be, you know, a very good team, to great team for the next 5-6 years. 50-32 that year, the Magic 42-40. So not actually that huge of a record difference. The SRS disparity, the Pistons were 2.97. The Magic were just under, were negative 0.39. So they were not a terrible team, but not obviously a very good one. Tracy McGrady, 32.1 points per game that season. Mike Miller on the team. Gordon Giercek, the legendary Gordon Giercek. Drew Gooden and Fat Sean Kemp.
The corpse of Sean Kemp is still there. Yes. Yeah.
So definitely in his big days for sure.
Yeah. So as far as the series, Tracy McGrady averaged 31.7 points per game and 6.7 rebounds per game. Ben Wallace was an absolute monster. It was kind of his coming out year. And then I think the series, especially, just an absolute monster. He averaged 17.9 rebounds per game and was just tenacious on defense and was known for, you know, in big moments, locking down Tracy McGrady when they really needed a big stop or a big win. So just an incredible year. I think he actually got MVP shares this year, too, which seemed kind of wild at the time. But he then sort of proved that wasn't all that wild the next few years. When he kind of emerged and kind of became a short-term defensive superstar, which is something that it's just hard to believe these days, that there was a time when like this guy who just did not score, didn't really want to score, was like a bona fide MVP contender. But it was there. I mean, he was a game changer at that point.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, of course, Ben Wallace actually played for the Magic, and he was part of the Grant Hill sign and trade. So he kind of almost a throw-in that, you know, no one really kind of knew what to do with him. You know, they thought a decent rebounder, but wasn't really special in 2000. And obviously, you know, unfortunately, because of injuries, Grant Hill didn't do very much in Orlando, and Ben Wallace, you know, became the defensive superstar in Detroit. So it's funny how things happen.
Yeah, exactly. The turning point of the entire series, game five, with the series in hand, Detroit holds Orlando to 67 points in a 98-67 win. Orlando would really never recover. Just real bad. ESPN.com recap, though. Tracy McGrady, you know, he didn't think so after that game. He says he walked off the court and he responded to Detroit's taunting fans by flashing three fingers, then two, to signify his team's lead in the series. There's no reason to get discouraged, McGrady said after the team's 31-point loss. They're still playing catch-up. Whoops, Detroit won the next two games, 103-88 and 108-93 to eliminate Orlando.
Not even close, really, yeah.
So, oops.
So the next season, the Pistons, moving on up, winning the NBA Finals after they add Rasheed Wallace, upset the Lakers that, of course, had Kobe and Shaq and also had added Karl Malone and Gary Payton the last year of the Kobe and Shaq era before Shaq is traded. Meanwhile, the Magic, they only won 21 games that year. They missed the NBA playoffs. Doc Rivers, who had been their coach, was fired 11 games a season. That was McGrady's last year in Orlando. He would be traded to the Rockets. So, and then the eventually the Magic would rebuild and get Dwight Howard and then form a new new pretty good run toward the end of the decade with under Stan Van Gundy. So a temporary blip for the Magic, a couple of not so great years before things would get better for them.
Yeah, they're pretty good at reinventing themselves a few times every so often. I don't know how long this little franchise is going to take now to get going again, but they've had to do it a few times in their career, and they've done it pretty well each of those times. So
right, the Magic have a tendency for superstars to end their tenures badly there and then have to rebuild on the fly, and then actually this is sort of the worst situation of that, at least the longest they've gone without making the playoffs. So we'll see how it goes. Next, 2006, the Western Conference first round, the Suns beating the Lakers, and the games were extremely close. The first four were all decided by single digits. One of the Lakers' wins came down to a single point, so a close beginning. The Suns that year, 54-28. It was the second straight year for Steve Nash winning the MVP and being the leader of the Suns. Sean Marion led the team in scoring and rebounding. Rajah Bell, also a great defensive player. Boris Diaw had come there. He had sort of taken the place of Amare Stoudemire after Amare had been injured for almost the entire season. And Tim Thomas came in and I think had played for the Knicks before there. Was it the Bulls? I forget.
He did. I think it might have been both. I think he definitely played for the Bulls that year. I don't know. Yeah. I think he was in a trade. I don't know if he started with the Bulls or yeah. something. I think he came in a trade or something like that. And yeah, it just was he with the Eddie Curry trade? That might be.
Tim Thomas definitely was with the Knicks later as well because he got a big contract with the Knicks, but I can't remember if he had been with the Knicks before that. Anyway,
yeah. Well, he probably parlayed. I think he parlayed this into the Knicks contract because he was awesome this year for the Suns. Yes. And like had like multiple great games and loved slapping the headband and making a fool of himself. But it was pretty great. This is like the Tim Thomas resurrection season, so it was the best thing ever. But
yeah, and he hit he hit the game winner in the next series against the Clippers.
But, yes.
Yeah, that's right. And then the Lakers, meanwhile, Kobe Bryant, and who had averaged 35.4 points per game that year, Lamar Odom, and not much else, Smush Parker.
It's really, I'm trying to find the third best player on this. Andrew Bynum was on the team, but he was like 18 and barely played, but right. That doesn't really quite count. Not a fun team at all. Pretty bad.
45, well, the record, 45-37, pretty good, 2.53 SRS, so, they weren't too bad on the court, but... and Phil Jackson had just recently come back, so they were on their path to building the team that eventually adding Pau Gasol, Bynum coming into his own and getting some good role players, and of course winning the two championships at the end of the decade. But we're quite a ways from that. They took the 3-1 lead in this series, and then Suns were able to turn it around.
Yeah, at a certain point, really pulling away, it would probably be Game 5 again, which obviously is a trend through many of these. Game 5 is really the big time. But of course, the Suns pulled away. They won Game 5 by 17 and then Game 7 by 31. This is an ESPN recap of that Game 7. The Phoenix Suns went from the brink to a blowout, from the edge of elimination to one of the most impressive turnarounds in NBA playoff history. And then Mike D'Antoni, of course, the Phoenix coach. I'm going to steal a line from Disney and say it's a small world after all. I guess small guys can play. That's about as good as we can play. Every one of our guys, I can't pick one out. All of them had an amazing game. I know this was famous because Leandro Barbosa kind of exploded out of nowhere. It was just like anybody at the Phoenix Suns. I mean, anything they touched went turned to gold, this season. Even without Amare Stoudemire, everything was going well. They grab anybody off the bench, they do well. You put Boris Diaw instead of a Stoudemire, didn't miss a beat, but it was just a perfect storm of things happening for Phoenix. Kobe, not so much for him and his Lakers. Here's his quote from the ESPN article. If we were going to get back in this type of game, we have to have everybody contributing. They just have a lot of talent over there, a lot of firepower. They stepped up to the challenge and kept coming at us in waves. We just didn't have enough in the tank to hold on. So,
and that was
a cry for help. Please get me somebody better than Kwame Brown. Would be great. Thank you.
Yes. And that was when Kobe, I don't think he took a shot. It was either in the fourth quarter or the entire second half.
Yep, that is exactly the one. I forgot what actually started that or whatever, but yeah, it's like kind of the famous one that you'll see where he doesn't look very pleased and he's just kind of not shooting at all. It's very strange. Yeah, it's as much of an on-court pouting as you can see especially from somebody who's so super competitive like Kobe.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird blip in his career. And then it wouldn't be, I think it was a season later where he demanded the trade and almost got traded, and they couldn't work out a deal, and then eventually he rescinded that and they got Pau Gasol, and the rest is history. But anyway, it's sort of an interesting, a little bit maybe a forgotten time in Lakers lore because, of course, how well things turned out after that. So next season, the Suns, they won 61 games but fell in somewhat controversial fashion to the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals. That was the famous Robert Horry hip checks Steve Nash, and a couple of Suns, including Amare Stoudemire, come off of the bench. But they're suspended anyway, and that prevents the Suns from they had no chance to win that series. Whether they would have been able to win that series or not is, of course, no one knows, but they definitely couldn't without those players. And then the Lakers that season, they won 42 games but lost to the Suns again in the first round. So it took a step back before things got better for them.
Absolutely.
And our last one, the 2015 Western Conference semifinals, Rockets over the Clippers. The Rockets had just been destroyed by Game 3 and 4, lost by 58 points combined in both games. And yeah, this series looked like the Rockets had absolutely no chance. The Clippers were, really doing great. They'd even won game one after Chris Paul had missed that game. It just really looked like the Clippers had just come off some great momentum from beating San Antonio in the first round. You and I did a podcast right after that game because that was just an exciting game. We were talking about other game sevens as well, but that one just really, was so exciting. It looked like, okay, maybe things are turning around for the Clippers. Maybe things will go really well, but not so much.
No, they're still the Clippers. So Houston came out hot on game five. It was 26 points from James Harden, 20 and 15 from Dwight Howard, and also 15 points off the bench for Corey Brewer. Game six once again saw Houston dominate. They won by 12 points before closing out the Clippers by 13 in game seven. James Harden scored 31 points. Dwight Howard had 16 and 15. And this is from NBA.com for one thrilling Sunday. This was like a Sunday afternoon game, too. It was a very odd, random Sunday afternoon game that this game seven was. But it was a super cool moment for, obviously Rockets fans and just to see kind of the collapse of the Clippers, but for one thrilling Sunday, it was perfect chaos. All these inspired men doing things that nobody had expected a week ago, exploding like a fiery red volcano after so many years of bubbling frustration. For one emotional afternoon, it was sheer madness. All the screaming and cheering, the rocking and rolling that made you feel as if you had just stepped inside a time warp.
Yeah, and that Rockets team was such a weird, obviously they have Dwight, they have James Harden, and they just have all these like really weird, Josh Smith steps up really well and hits a bunch of random threes. Yeah, I think that was in game six. And that was that huge comeback that they had that just totally just blitzed them. Like I said, the Clippers looked like they were going to totally win game six, and then, just everything turned around. It was just one of the craziest switches in momentum that I've ever seen in an individual game, and that obviously typified what happened in that series. Next season, the Rockets, only 41 games. Coach Kevin McHale will be fired after 11 games. They'd be eliminated in the playoffs in five games by the Warriors in the first round, not putting up much of a fight there, despite the Warriors losing Steph Curry for a few games in that series. Clippers, meanwhile, did pretty well the next season, despite Blake Griffin missing quite a bit of time. They won 52 games, but then lost in Western Conference first round to the Trailblazers after Griffin was hurt again and Chris Paul was hurt. I think they both were hurt like in the same game, if I remember that correctly. So
yeah.
So not a good situation for them. And of course, both teams, we'll see what happens for this upcoming season, because both have interesting expectations that we'll see how that goes. So thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at the Step Back, our new home at Fansided. And you can also find us on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Just search for Over and Back. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.